Only 3% of federal drug defendants go to trial. The rest take plea bargain agreements that offer shorter sentences than they might have received if they've gone to trial. Jamie Fellner, a senior advisor to the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, believes that federal prosecutors routinely threaten drug defendants with extraordinarily severe prison sentences to coerce them into waiving their right to a trial and pleading guilty. Her Human Rights Watch report on the issue is called An Offer You Can't Refuse, How U.S. Federal Prosecutors Force Drug Defenders to Plead Guilty. I'm very pleased to welcome her back to our show. Hi, Jamie.
I'm pleased to be here.
3% sounds like an extraordinarily low number of federal drug defendants that choose to go to trial. Doesn't that just suggest that those people, that all the others, the 97%, committed the crime and they just are willing to admit it?
I don't think so. You know, in 1980, 30% of drug defendants went to trial. I don't think there's been a huge increase in the number who are guilty and therefore waive their rights. What's going on is not so much a question of guilt. And remember, the government has the burden of proving you guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. What's going on is that defendants simply can't risk going to trial because the sentence would be so much higher. When you have a prosecutor say, look, if you plead, you'll get 10 years. If you go to trial, you'll be convicted and you're going to get a life without parole sentence. That's the kind of, as the title says, an offer you can't refuse.
And the prosecutors determine the length of the sentence?
They do because of mandatory minimums. Mandatory minimums mean that the judge cannot sentence below the minimum set by law. So they could... judges can sentence higher, but when a prosecutor charges you with an offense carrying a 10-year mandatory minimum, even if you're just a low-level person who nobody thinks deserves 10 years, the judge has no choice but to impose it if you're convicted.
Even if the judge thinks that it's a bad case.
Absolutely. But the judge won't know if it's a bad case in terms of the evidence. In fact, the defendant won't know if the prosecutor has a bad case because the prosecutors don't have to show all their evidence. You have to plead not knowing how strong the government's case is.
So this is quite different than what happens on the state level, isn't it? Or were similar things happening when the Rockefeller drug laws were in effect? Well, they're still in effect, but they have been
modified.
They've
changed a lot, right. I hear, and I haven't done any research myself into state plea bargaining. But the bottom line is the same. Prosecutors can make it very, very costly for you not to plead.
Now, if 97% of the accused in drug cases plead guilty to avoid going to trial, they're assuming that they're likely to be convicted?
You mean if they went to trial?
If they went to trial.
Yes. Only 10% of people, drug defendants who go to trial are acquitted. So there's a high likelihood that you'll be convicted if you go to trial.
Can the prosecutor set the terms of the plea bargains that they offer?
In essence, yes. I mean, you have to agree to it, you, the defendant. The judge won't change it. In fact, federal judges, by rule, are not allowed to participate in plea negotiations.
What about legal counsel? Can defendants get legal counsel in the negotiations?
Well, in fact, it's mostly between legal counsel and the prosecutor, and then the legal counsel goes to the defendant and says, you know, do you want to take this? These are the odds, et cetera.
And since many of these people are represented by public defenders who have heavy caseloads, do the public defenders often say it's better just to take the deal?
Well, you know, federal cases, the public defenders are the federal public defenders who are extremely qualified, careful. They're excellent lawyers. Federal defendants are also represented by private counsel. Whether private counsel or public defenders, they know and often will counsel the defendants that if you don't take the plea, you could be facing a much, much longer sentence. So they recognize what the odds are. And, you know, one of the reasons that prosecutors make good on their threats is because they want defense counsel to know that they will do so.
Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy has spoken out against these mandatory minimum sentences. He said, I can accept neither the necessity nor the wisdom of mandatory minimum sentences in too many cases. Mandatory minimum sentences are unwise and unjust. Now, what do the supporters of them say?
The supporters of mandatory minimums don't have a lot of facts on their side, but they certainly have a lot of rhetoric. You know, Senator Chuck Schumer is a big supporter of mandatory minimums, and it's a tragedy because he's standing in the way of some important reform right now in the Hill. The supporters say, look, it reduces crime because we have more people in prison for longer. It promotes cooperation, i.e., and it promotes pleas. They know full well it makes it easier for prosecutors to get convictions. But there's no solid evidence that mandatory minimums have, in fact, led to lower crime rates.
My guest is Jamie Fellner, a senior advisor to the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. Her piece, her study, An Offer You Can't Refuse, How U.S. Federal Prosecutors Force Drug Defendants to Plead Guilty, has just been released by Human Rights Watch. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, can the large growth in the prison population in the past 30 years be traced directly to these sentences in these drug cases?
Absolutely. I mean, drug cases have risen by a huge proportion in federal prison, now matched only by immigration cases. I wanted to go back to something about you asked about what do supporters say. It's ironic, in the mid-1980s when Congress enacted the mandatory minimums, one of its concerns was that judges were issuing wildly different sentences in different cases for essentially the same crime. What we have now are wildly different sentences for essentially the same crime, depending on which prosecutor has your case. So we haven't solved the problem of uneven sentences by sidelining judges.
So the deciding factors are not the drug involved, the amount of drugs involved, whether a person is a kingpin or just a drug user or a small-time dealer?
Well, the law is keyed. The drug laws are keyed to the quantity of drug and the type of drug. But there's a lot of flexibility there depending on what the prosecutor wants to charge. If you have prior convictions, they can be for small possession of drugs years ago in a state. The prosecutor can get your sentence doubled or even, as I pointed out earlier, changed from a 10-year sentence to a life. Prosecutors have a lot of flexibility. And remember, we not only have the mandatory minimum sentencing laws, we have sentencing guidelines, which throw in other factors that prosecutors can play with. And by the way, the existence of the guidelines, I think the current guidelines are misguided because they're too severe. They were pegged to the mandatory minimums. But having guidelines means that judges, if sentencing discretion were restored to them, they wouldn't be able to be all over the board in terms of the length of sentences, right? When judges make decisions, there's transparency, there's accountability, there's the possibility to appeal. When prosecutors make these decisions, there's no transparency, there's no accountability, and you can't appeal it.
You point out in your report that the number of drug defendants incarcerated in 1980 was 4,749. And now, 33 years later, in 2013, the number is 100,026. Should I assume that more people are being arrested for drugs or just that they're staying in prisons for a lot longer?
It's both. I mean, I don't talk about arrests in the report, but yes, arrests have gone up, but the length of sentences for prisons, the length of sentences for drug offenses went up with the mandatory minimums. And I have to point out, for all these people in prison and people who've gone in and out of prison, drugs are just as available. The rates of addiction, the rates of use haven't changed all that much. I mean, a lot of people are starting to question not only can we incarcerate our way out of drugs, but whether the whole premise of using law enforcement as the principal method, it makes any sense.
You write that in 2012, the average sentence of federal drug offenders convicted at trial was three times higher than the sentence received after a guilty plea. Why such a huge discrepancy?
That's the trial penalty. That's what happens if you don't plead.
So what is the average sentence for drug defendants who take a plea?
Well, that all depends on what they were originally charged with. But the gross overall sentence, including all drug defendants, is 5 years, more or less. And if you go to trial, you're looking at 15 years.
So most of us would probably accept the plea bargain if we were faced with that kind of choice.
I think so, and I think that accounts for the 97%.
But are you should we assume that most of those people actually are guilty of the crime, whether the sentence is, as you feel, inordinately large?
You know, when you say guilty of the crime, what is the crime? Did they possess the drug? Were they intending to sell it? Did they know how much drug they possessed? I mean, if I'm hired to drive drugs across town, I may know I'm driving drugs across town, but I don't know what drugs or how much. And yet I can be charged with, depending on the quantity, I could be charged with an offense carrying 10 years. Am I guilty of that offense that carries the 10 years? I mean, prosecutors, the government has the burden of proving you guilty. You are innocent until proven guilty. The way it works now is the whole presumption of innocence gets thrown out and is irrelevant, and it's a question of whether the defendant is willing to roll the dice or not.
And some of the examples you give seem kind of shocking. Darlene Eccles received a terrible sentence. What was her situation?
She was a nursing assistant who had the great, with no prior criminal record, who had the great misfortune of having a drug dealing brother. Her brother got out of prison. He was in on a drug charge, comes out, doesn't have a place to live, lives with her. She lets him live with her, and he starts dealing again. She counts money for him sometimes, and she lets him stay in the house for 6 months. A while later, there's a big sweep and all the members of this gang are arrested. She's arrested, too, and accused of drug trafficking. She refused to plead guilty because she was convinced she was innocent of drug trafficking. All she did was let her brother stay and sometimes counted his money. She got 20 years. Her brother, who pled and cooperated, including by testifying against her, got 12.
She was convicted for being a facilitator, not a drug user.
Drug user isn't a sort of a relevant concept here. Facilitator just means she was part of the drug conspiracy, and the government hammered her because she wouldn't plead.
So she got almost 20 years. What was the plea bargain that had been offered her?
If I remember correctly, it was around 10.
Still a long time for somebody who feels she hasn't done anything wrong.
Absolutely. But many prosecutors believe deeply in long sentences as appropriate for people who are involved in drugs.
Another case that you cite from recently, August this year, is Roy Lee Clay. Prosecutors said that he was part of a 14-person heroin trafficking ring. He didn't take the plea bargain. And his first trial was ended in a hung jury.
His first trial ended in a hung jury. Clay's case exemplifies, again, the weirdness or strangeness of this situation. The prosecutor offered him a 10-year plea. Clay wouldn't take it. Because Clay had some priors, when he wouldn't take the plea, even after the first trial, he gets tried again. The prosecutor's files a sentencing enhancement, which makes Clay's sentence, when he is convicted, as he ultimately was, a life sentence. How could the same prosecutor who believed a 10-year sentence was appropriate for Clay now feel a life sentence is appropriate? And I asked him this. I asked the prosecutor that. He made the mistake of picking up the phone when I called. And I asked him if he thought this was a just sentence. He would not respond. He just said that it applied. The law permitted him to do this, and therefore he wasn't going to get into discussions of whether or not this was a fair or just way to proceed.
What did the judge at the trial say about the sentence?
She thought it was too harsh. In fact, many, many of the cases I have read, you have judges basically wringing their hands because they have no choice but to impose sentences that they think are out of bounds, beyond the bounds.
Does Roy Lee Clay have any legal recourse following this kind of conviction and sentencing?
Well, I know his—
Can you appeal these cases? I mean, a life sentence?
They're very rarely overturned.
So this is not like DNA where you say, well, it proves that I didn't do it.
No. No, no, no. He has to find some kind of flaw, withheld evidence that should have been. And I don't know the specifics of his case well enough to know if he has some credible basis for appealing. Sandra Avery, a woman who was a crack addict, had picked up 3 prior state convictions for possessing crack for her own use. She then goes to college, becomes an accountant, goes in the Army, gets jobs, and all is well until her life took some sort of started falling apart. She married a man who was dealing drugs, and she started dealing drugs with him. She was offered a plea to 10 years, minimum of 10 years, which she did not take. So the prosecutor, relying on those prior convictions for which she never served any time, minor convictions, she's now serving life without parole.
There has, it's been argued for quite a while that the sentencing for crack has been a lot harder than the sentencing for cocaine. And that's because people who use crack are less affluent, actually.
Well, it's both. When Congress made the much tougher sentences for crack, which, as you know, have been rolled back
considerably. Unless you're the mayor of Toronto, and then you decide you're going to run for office again.
Yeah, the crack sentences aren't as harsh as they used to be relative to powder cocaine. But I think it's fair to say that when Congress originally in the mid-'80s put these really harsh crack sentences in place, they were concerned about black inner-city people using crack. And it's curious because the numbers of whites who use crack have always been far greater than the number of blacks, not the rate, but the absolute numbers.
Jamie Fellner's report, An Offer You Can't Refuse, How U.S. Federal Prosecutors Force Drug Defendants to Plead Guilty, has been released by the Human Rights Watch. And we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We are back with Jamie Fellner, who is a senior advisor to the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch, and her report for Human Rights Watch, An Offer You Can't Refuse, How U.S. Federal Prosecutors Force Drug Defendants to Plead Guilty, has just been released, and there's been a lot of newspaper coverage of it. Have you received any responses? Are people outraged that seem to be sympathetic to people who have been convicted of drug abuse?
I haven't yet heard from any prosecutors. The Justice Department issued a statement saying, well, we don't think, you know, defendants should be coerced. And we are seeking a meeting with the Attorney General to discuss with him what steps he might take. The main public comments in terms of coverage in the press have been very, you know, shocked. I don't think most people realized this is the way the system worked. If you're a defense counsel or a prosecutor or a judge, nothing in my report is new. But if you're just a member of the general public and you realize the kind of power that prosecutors have and are willing to wield, it's rather shocking. And it's not about whether you are guilty or innocent. It's whether or not you're willing to plead.
And they were given this power by Congress? Congress agreed on something? It must have been at a time when actually both houses voted for the same legislation.
I don't think Congress fully realized what it was doing. Or at least
when was this?
In the mid-'80s, mm-hmm. when they passed the mandatory minimums. But prosecutors have always been powerful, and they certainly are powerful in states, for example, where they're not mandatory minimums. It's just in the federal system they have this particular set of weapons, and they're willing to use it.
And as you said earlier, the rationale was that they felt that judges were too uneven in their sentencing.
That was part of it. They also thought they were too lenient.
So when people have gone to Congress since, when people in Congress received this kind of report, and you mentioned Eric Holder is now thinking about whether something should be done about this, what has been the response in Congress?
Congress, well, you know, right now they are still sort of debating whether or not they're going to even get out of committee a legislation called the Safe Sentencing Act. It's hard for me to know. Is it that they're still concerned about being called soft on crime? Is it they don't want to tell their constituents that they are lowering the sentences for drug traffickers? It's hard to believe it's a matter of principle because I don't see any principle involved here except one that says the sentences are too long and they don't accomplish anything.
Well, how do these sentences compare to sentences for other crimes like rape, armed robbery, murder?
In the federal, they can get quite close depending. I mean, but let's go to the extreme of life without parole. Who should get life without parole? I'm not sure who should get life without parole.
Maybe, well, a mass murderer.
Maybe a mass murderer. But, you know, life without parole isn't even used in the International Criminal Court for people convicted of genocide, mass murder. So, I mean, there's a question as to whether it's ever permissible. But let's assume it is. You could imagine a mass murderer getting life without parole then. But Sandra Avery, who was at worst a crack dealer for part of her life, should she get life without parole?
Did any prosecutors tell you that they purposely want to keep drug defendants from going to trial?
They want convictions. They absolutely want convictions, and they want convictions with the least possible expenditure of resources. You know, if you plead, then you don't have to, then all the prosecutor has to have done is gather enough evidence to get a grand jury indictment. After that, there's very little work that needs to be done if the defendant pleads. So it saves time, it saves resources, it's less wear and tear on the witnesses. From a prosecutor standpoint, it's a win-win to get these convictions by pleading.
Now, what leads to a case being a federal case in drugs? Because I'm assuming that in most instances, we're talking about somebody involved in drugs in one state or another.
State and federal drug laws pretty much complement each other or cover the same ground. There can be arrangements as to who takes which cases. The feds have always said that they take the more serious cases, but when they round up a gang or a big conspiracy, that case may have a couple of big fish, but the rest are all little guys who could easily have been prosecuted in state court.
Because none of the cases you're citing involve kingpins.
No, there are very few kingpin cases. One former U.S. attorney I talked to said, you know, another U.S. attorney told him he could count on one hand the number of kingpins he ever prosecuted. It's all little guys. I mean, the Sentencing Commission did a study and found something like 50% of the drug defendants in prison had been convicted of low-level jobs, but it had low-level jobs in the drug business.
Well, we often hear about people who've been arrested being coerced into naming other people, higher-ups, as a way of reducing their sentences. Is that part of the same process?
Well, that's part of the theory. The thing is that the people who are at the bottom don't have any names to name, or if they know some names, chances are law enforcement has already gotten those people. So it's the people at the top who are most likely to be able to offer information to the government in exchange for a much lower sentence. And they do.
And who would they give up?
They'd give up everybody below them. I mean, remember we talked about Rick Eccles. Rick Eccles, he was Darlene Eccles' brother. He gave her up. He testified against her. That was part of
brotherly
his plea
love.
Agreement. Oh, absolutely. Her sister also. And her sister ended up with probation.
Now, laws, some states are rethinking drug laws in general in regard to marijuana. And we even have Uruguay, a whole country, deciding that they should decriminalize marijuana use. How is that going to affect this? I mean, if somebody has had priors in Colorado where there are new drug laws, or in Washington, the state of Washington, is that going to affect the federal cases?
That's an interesting question. Could a federal prosecutor seek an enhancement based on state convictions for marijuana use or sales? I don't know.
Before
that the law
it was legalized in the state.
I don't know if it addresses that or not. You know, mentioning the marijuana law changes, I was just reading a book in which the author reminded us that in the 1970s, public opinion polls had something like, I think it was 2/3 or 3/4 of adults said that marijuana possession should receive a life sentence.
Wow.
I mean, it's staggering to think of how times have changed and people have understood both more about the nature of the drug, but also have delinked the notion of morality from the law in these sort of private choice matters.
Is there a certain irony in the fact that some of the people who would like to decriminalize are on what we might consider the American right, the libertarians?
I don't think there's an irony at all. I think that is the way they should be. I mean, if they're true to their principles, I think what's surprising is how many people claim to be conservatives, and yet, I mean, this is something everybody knows. Conservatives have been quite willing to have the government meddle in all kinds of personal decisions, but didn't want the government involved in regulating economic activities. There's an irony there, which is starting to sort of come unraveled, I think.
So how would you recommend changes? What kinds of changes would you recommend?
Well, first, with regard to plea bargaining, I think we have recommendations in the report directed at Congress and directed at the Attorney General. In terms of Congress, Congress needs to do something about mandatory minimum sentencing. They were badly conceived, and we've now had almost 30 years of their implementation, and they're a disaster. And one of the pieces of that disaster is this trial penalty. But there are many other aspects of why a system of mandatory minimums is not a sound criminal justice system. The other if you got rid of mandatory minimums, then prosecutors could threaten and bluster, but they wouldn't be able to come through on their threats, because a judge might say, well, yes, you have secured a life enhancement for this person, but I don't think that's a fair sentence, so I'm not going to impose it. The other set of recommendations we have go to the Attorney General. The Attorney General last August said that he wanted just sentences for low-level drug defendants, and he wanted prosecutors not to charge them with harsh mandatory minimum offenses and with not to use the sentencing enhancements based on prior conviction except when the circumstances warranted. This was, you know, these are welcome initiatives by him. I think the directives he issued to prosecutors are flawed because they're overbroad and the criteria are easily avoided, and they won't stop coercive plea bargaining. But there is much he could do if he made it a department priority that prosecutors should use their discretion to secure sentences that are fair and proportionate to the crime, and that they should not then seek, you know, threaten enhancements. That would be a huge step forward.
A caller says that the Correctional Officers Union was influential in getting mandatory minimum sentences enacted as a job security measure. Is that possible?
I don't think that was true for the federal laws. But certainly correctional officers unions in New York and California and many states have played a major role in supporting harsh laws and trying to prevent them from being overturned.
Now, you mentioned that Chuck Schumer, who most people would think of as a civil libertarian, has been somewhat of an impediment in having these laws changed. Have you spoken to him?
I have not. Other people working on changes and reforms to federal law have. He and people in and Human Rights Watch staff have talked with his staff. He, you know, he's a true believer. He was an old prosecutor long ago, and he's still anything that decreases the power of prosecutors is not something he's in favor of.
On the other hand, we have 100,000 or so people in our prisons, and often when we talk about ways of saving money, one of the ways we discuss is releasing prisoners who are unlikely to commit a crime. Some of these people have life without parole, I imagine. They're getting on in years, and you've done a report on that as well in the past.
There's so many ways in which our criminal justice system doesn't make sense, but certainly keeping people in prison long past any sort of period of time for retribution, long past any point of, you know, diminishing returns for public safety, makes no sense from an economic perspective or from a criminal justice perspective. I think there's growing recognition both on the Hill and in the public at large that we need to seriously rethink our approach to crime and punishment in this country. It's gotten out of whack. But it takes time, and it takes time for public officials to sort of, you know, get the courage to do what's right.
Well, if judges feel that the system is unfair, I would assume that there are some prosecutors who also think the system is unfair. Are they just caught up in the system, have no choice but to act this way?
Well, I can't say that I talked to prosecutors who thought it was unfair. Look, I talked to prosecutors who said, we worked hard to try and get the defendant a fair deal. But they also said if the defendant didn't take the deal, then all bets were off and we'd throw the book at him. It's sort of up to the defendant to plead if he wants a fair sentence. That's not the way justice should work.
So you see this as a human rights issue?
Absolutely. I mean, from a human rights perspective, you have a right to fair trial procedures. You have a right to presumption of innocence. You have a right not to be coerced into giving up your liberty.
A listener has called in to say that Charles Schumer was never a prosecutor.
Okay. I stand corrected.
So,
thank you.
He has other reasons for feeling strongly about this.
Well, someday I hope he is willing to come on your show and explain them and you can ask him good questions.
Jamie Fellner is a senior advisor to the U.S. program at Human Rights Watch. Her report, An Offer You Can't Refuse, How U.S. Federal Prosecutors Force Drug Defendants to Plead Guilty, has been released by Human Rights Watch. And, Jamie, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, although you always come here with bad news.
It does. Sometime I'll come and talk about ballroom dancing or something
okay.
fun.
Okay. I'm looking forward to it.
Thanks.